and welcome to the Disability Education in Society podcast. This is a podcast for collective learning and unlearning in the struggle for intersectional liberation. We focus on educational realms, expanding to other societal areas. We share our stories as academics, as well as those of our featured guests, including disability activists involved with multifaceted dimensions of systems equity, self-determination efforts, anti-ableist, and anti-racist liberation. Join us as co-conspirators.
On today's episode, we have Allison Mirren. Allison is a postdoctoral research associate in mathematics education at the University of Arizona. Before earning her PhD in mathematics education, she obtained an MA in mathematics and taught at a Waldorf school. Allison is dedicated to supporting all students, with a special focus on those with disabilities and their engagement with mathematical reasoning. She is particularly interested in the role of explicit mathematical inference making and explanation across diverse mathematical contexts.
Welcome to the Disability Education Society podcast. We are so thrilled today to have Allison join us, and we're going to have a great conversation. I could already tell based on right before we hit recording, we already spent, I think, about 30 minutes just talking about various things that...
After all the good stuff was.
Yeah, and probably should have started recording back then, but nonetheless... Allison, before I ask you a question, I just want to share with all of the folks here in the DES community that you recently received an awesome award from the University of Arizona. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that award?
Yeah, I was very pleased to receive it. I received, I and somebody else from another department received the award for Outstanding Postdoctoral Scholar. And the very exciting thing about the award is they give me money to do research, and I cannot wait to get the opportunity to actually compensate teachers for their time as I get to learn more about teaching mathematics.
Well, congratulations again. And this is well deserved. We know you for a few years, and we know you've done so much, made so many contributions, and you will continue to do so in the future as well. And yes, we're going to be talking about teachers here today. We're talking about math education. And before we do, I do want to ask you, have you, Allison, share a little bit about a personal story related to your interest in disability?
So I'm going to share a couple of things, if that's okay, because, well, not everybody listening to this knows me. I'm not that great at being concise. But so the general thing here is there's been this big journey for me about convincing people that the way that I adapt to my disabilities is legitimate and professional and not being questioned about it. And you know, since getting my PhD, I feel like I've in some sense proven myself, and I'm not questioned in the same way that I used to be. And I have all these other forms of privilege, I think, that lead me to being questioned less. And I want other people to be able to have the same privilege I have now of being able to engage and adapt to my disabilities without being questioned about it. So for me, I have a chronic illness. One of them is called POTS, and it makes being upright difficult. I can do it, but it comes with a cost. And, you know, one common incident that happens is people actually laughing at me when I sit down and put my legs up. If I have to put my legs up at conferences or I have to sit down to give a talk, I've had other colleagues think it's funny, or sometimes in a friendly way say, oh, that laugh, and say, oh, that's really cute how you give your talk sitting down. The other thing I really wanted to share is I have something called nonverbal learning disorder, and VLD. And what that means, technically what it means is that there's a strong deficit in like my verbal skills versus, let's just say, visual motor perceptual skills. But the reason I'm sharing this is because one of like the main things I hear about with nonverbal learning disability, and one of the main symptoms is struggling with math. And as somebody who does math, this is something that's impacted me a lot. And I think the other thing I'd like to share while I'm here is I also got into math education partially by working with students with disabilities through tutoring. And also as a high school teacher, I worked with sort of these supposed lower level students. And in my class, I discovered that so many of them had this fantastic mathematical reasoning and fantastic thinking. And they just hadn't had the opportunity to really explore that in the memorization-based classes before. I think one student said to me once, is math just writing numbers different ways? Or, we're not doing math in this class, we're just doing reasoning. So I've had a lot of experiences that, that really influence a lot of my perspectives here.
Wonderful. For me, this insight is very, very valuable. I am neither a mathematics educator in the strict sense. I'm not a special ed certified expert. I'm both a disability studies mathematics education researcher and a disability advocate. And I'm very much interested in STEM elements for folks with disabilities because I see that as a space for higher wages and upper mobility for people with disabilities, especially people with intellectual disabilities, and some of the disability rankings that are lower in the hierarchy of disabilities. Because the first thing we have to admit is in the world of disabilities, there are those hierarchies. And it's in the STEM disciplines is where you see a lot of that. So I use this to preface my question because you've talked to us about this disconnect between mathematical teaching and the way students learn, and especially students with disabilities learn. I'd like you to, if you could expand a little bit about that idea, because I think that there is a lot of depth for our audience, educational psychologists, people who are coming from other educational learning sciences, perhaps, or maybe social science people who may benefit from that reflection.
So before going into that, I wanted to say I like your insight about sort of this hierarchy and disabilities. And I've seen this in some of my physical disability spaces where people will say things like, oh, don't assume my brain doesn't work just because my body doesn't. And while it's true that we shouldn't make those assumptions about people, often there's this sort of undertone of, well, I'm not one of those disabled people. I'm not one of those disabled people who has mind problems. It's just my body. And I see that discourse a lot. Even when people talk about me, they say, yeah, you're disabled, but you're smart, so it's okay. So that's also the other thing that was really interesting to me. And what you said was about the STEM acronym, because when I first went into this, people would say, oh, you're into STEM education. And I'd say, I'm into M education. I don't know much about the STE, but it's about, opportunities, productivity, and capitalism. So we have that grouping there when we talk about STEM education. STEM is this construct that really reflects society's values and purposes for math education. And well, why are we grouping it with that instead of philosophy? Why, I think about this as somebody, I have a BA, an MA, and a PhD, no S's, right? But to get to your question, I've been thinking about this issue a lot recently, and I sort of see sort of these two issues, which is that in this, well, okay, there's a bit of a dichotomy in the discourse, where on the one hand, we have the kind of math that's like this procedure-based, like how to explicit instruction, here's the algorithm. On the other hand, we have this other type of thing that's maybe more discovery, that's maybe more implicit, and is more sort of like maybe in some ways more inductive, more open-ended. And I feel like that's how a lot of people think about math education is, okay, there's the traditional procedure, step-by-step stuff, and here's our like loosey-goosey concepts in new math. Or whatever. Yeah, I'm caricaturizing here, but, and both, I mean, I have an issue with that dichotomy. So the first thing
it's
that-
binary, you're essentially describing the binary nature. Instead of looking at a spectrum of possibilities, it's dichotomized, right?
Plus, even if there was a spectrum, this notion that explicit is over here with procedures and implicit is over here with concepts, I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. And I'll explain in a bit how this relates to disability, but one of the things that I'm pushing for that I've been writing about right now is something I'm calling inferential reasoning. And I don't feel like there's a place for it right now in the mathematics education discourse. And that's one reason I'm working on this. It's fairly well known in math education research circles that there's an issue with just doing rote procedures, right? Like I once taught a college algebra course where I had to work with their system and each topic was just a procedure and students had like over 100 different topics to keep track of. And based on my cognitive interviews, it was just procedures. And sort of this work I'm doing right now is looking at how students understand their own mathematical inscriptions when they're doing these procedures. Because I think that fundamentally students see their writing as recording mathematical activity or computation, not as stating true things or making as inferences. So this sort of forms a big disconnect between our curricular aims, where we want students to, you know, like write true things. This happens like in equal sign literature, where we want students to write true equations. But students don't think they're trying to write true things. Students are, documenting their work, which doesn't mean they're writing false things. It's just a different aim with writing and communicating. And so I think a lot of students think, okay, you know, in this explicit instruction concept situation, here I've been given the rules for how I move the symbols around a page, right? Sometimes the mysterious they, tell me exactly how to do it. Other times I have to use a variety of cues to figure it out and then get to the right answer. So one of the areas where I'm seeing like great changes here is with Common Core, where I think they really are at least implicitly introducing inferences into procedures so that students can make sense of these procedures. But I think one of these big disconnects that's happening is it's still being interpreted in this procedure answer getting context. So teachers and students and parents look at it and, you know, they see this, you know, quote, Common Core method for say adding or something. And they say, well, this is just a more convoluted way of getting an answer. Why would I do this? I think, you know, recently it was going around internet spaces where a student was given an example of how to, you know, add 9 and 3. And the example was to say, okay, well, you should do 9 + 1 + 2. Because 9 + 1 = 10 and then 10 + 2 = 12. And people were very upset by it. And my interpretation is because they're looking at it with this lens of, I'm being taught this method of solving problems. Why am I being taught this hard method? As opposed to using this as an opportunity to develop number sense and make inferences. So that's sort of like the fundamental thing underlying my work is how are people looking at inscriptions in terms of how they think about what it means to do mathematics and how are sort of disabled people and even non-disabled people positioned in this sort of like, here we have the explicit procedures, here we have the you know, implicit discovery type stuff.
So in terms of, you know, one thing that I do as a person with disabilities, I believe in pan-disability, cross-disability things. Mm-hmm. But I typically talk from my experience as a blind person, and because that's what I know best, and that's where I have all my musings and my questions and whatever. Yeah. In terms of NVLD, mm-hmm. How would you say the inferential reasoning is connected to that disconnect of diagnosis or the recipes that are provided for special education people or even mathematics experts to deal with NVLD folks and quote unquote fix their capacity to do mathematics or push them away because they, no matter what they do, they will never be able to do it. I don't know. I'm probably extending too much to ask. The question is, how is NVLD specifically connected to the disconnect in your view?
Okay. So I like how you described your positionality here, because one of the things I really struggle with in discourse is centering myself, because I want to say things, but I only have my own perspective, but then I'm centering myself, and that's hard, right? So I was just kind of curious right now to see how it's discussed, and I Googled NVLD symptoms and math. And the first result was, math is based on visual spatial concepts. Is it?
Right.
I mean, I think that's one way of conceptualizing math. So
I feel like you're that's blind, the dominant way.
You're blind, you cannot do mathematics, or if you have any kind of learning disability that prevents you from doing, you're basically out of it, right? I mean, that's that's what people will read into it.
Yeah. And so I think a lot of this, sorry, go on, Paolo.
No, I was just going to concur with what Alexis and you were both saying, is that a common phrase you hear a lot in the math education community and math community probably is like, math is visual, and it's just stated as a fact. And and that typically comes from folks who have visual abilities. And so then they just make that statement and say and claim that's math and just pretty much dismiss everything else that's non-visual, if you will.
I mean, I think that's what a lot of this comes down to with this disconnect when we're talking about disabilities that could affect the way that people do math. Often what happens is, you know, these disabilities are written about in a way. I mean, I'm using nonverbal learning disability as an example, but I think it generalizes a bit in that a lot of times people talk about these disabilities causing people to be, quote, be bad at math. And I would say, I'm not going to tell somebody what they're good or bad at, right? If somebody says they can't do something, I think it's very important to believe them. However, often I think the way the word math is being used when discussing these disabilities is often math as construed in sort of this traditional K-12 context, sort of the procedures and practices in terms of how math is done it and assessed in this K-12 concept.
And I'm thinking the same people usually say geometry is spatial. geometry is bad part of mathematics. And so you're privileging certain types of quote unquote abilities or disabilities by using these qualifiers, spatial, visual, whatever, auditory or whatever adjective you choose to connect to mathematics, and say, you know, God is love kind of thing. It's like it has this whatever, this profound philosophical definitional thing that once you said that, there is nothing else to say, because I mean, you've captured everything about disability, everything about mathematics in this statement that only usually has three words, as you know, like this profound theorem of sorts.
I love that you gave geometry as an example, because it's such a, like when we're talking, when students are taught Euclidean axiomatic geometry, that is such an interesting example to me, because I thrived in geometry because it's axiomatic and proof-based. And it's not that I was necessarily visually reasoning, or if I was, I was doing it, I was definitely not processing at the same speed as other people. I was translating a lot of it to verbal information and translating back. And, you know, when most people think geometry, they think pictures. But when we're talking about often geometry as a field, we're often talking about geometry in the context of the history of mathematics, in which we're talking about an axiomatic system, which fundamentally can be done non-visually. You know,
inferentially.
Yeah, exactly. Inferentially. And it's one of those times where, like, I remember taking this like history of geometry, Euclidean and non-Euclidean class in college, and I made it a challenge to write up all my proofs without pictures. I don't think the professor was too happy about it, but I think this is, you know, a lot of, when you look at a lot of symptoms of learning disabilities, and particularly people with nonverbal learning disability, you run into issues where people have trouble with multi-step directions. Well, what about the multi-step directions in math problems? Or what about the social cueing that happens when you're giving directions? Keeping track of symbols on a page, that sort of visual reasoning, and the way that we do school math. And one of the things that I think is really, really sad is a lot of these students never get an opportunity to do inferential mathematics because they're required to get past this procedural stuff first. Like, I think I've seen situations where vector calculus, calculus 3, is a prerequisite for taking an introduction to proofs course or an introduction to set theory course. And of course, there's, you know, universities have done the analysis about, like, okay, if you require this prerequisite, sure, overall quantitatively students might do better, might filter out some students, but it could also filter out some very strong students who, you know, might struggle with the heavy, heavy, heavy sort of visual, spatial, sensory focus that happens in multivariable calculus. And that's very sad to me. And I've encountered a lot of these people in philosophy departments. So I had a double major in college. Philosophy is my first true love. Math was kind of an accident. And I run into plenty of philosophers who say, well, I never, you know, went far with math, but they did, you know, very well in logic, because they never got the opportunity to do math outside of like this procedural and visual emphasis situation.
So Allison, right. Going back to what you were talking about, inferential mathematics, can you say a little bit more about that for those that might not be so familiar? Because, I mean, you talked about sort of how the sequence is set up, like you have to go through all these just to be able to have opportunities to do inferential mathematics. What is inferential mathematics?
Okay, so I promise I will eventually get to your question in a slightly roundabout way, as I do. I think a lot of it, okay, so we make deductive inferences, you know, there's all sorts of things, you know, if this is true, then this is true, therefore that is true. Okay. I mean, I don't think I should go and define deduction now because I'm sure I would mess it up, but you can kind of picture that you would do this sort of reasoning where you're explicit about the deductive inferences. You make, you know, conclusions based on premises, or the conclusions follow the premises, you make these inferences. And this happens regularly in proof-based mathematics. You know, in a proof, you're talking about your inferences explicitly when you write a mathematical proof. And often in procedure-based mathematics, these inferences are kind of hidden under the surface. So let's talk about if we've set up some sort of word problem, or maybe we're like solving for X in an equation, and we have like, you know, X squared minus 9 equals 0, solve for X. Okay, well, students might add 9 to both sides, take the square root, get X equals plus 3 minus 3, plus or minus 3, write a little comma between the minus 3 and the plus 3, or maybe the plus minus sign. But making an inference would be connecting that procedure to the problem. It would be being able to understand, okay, we're trying to find all the values of X that make X squared minus 9 equals 0 true. Okay. Well, the values of X that make that true are the same values of X that make X squared equals 9 true. And the values of X that make that true are precisely 3 and negative 3.
I'm probably going to mess this up, but I'm thinking of the expression backward mapping. It's almost like a backward, mental backward mapping that people do to get to the problem through the procedure, right?
Yeah, it involves linking the procedure to the question at hand. And these inferences are often given in textbooks in the beginning, but when students start solving the problems, they're like, okay, now we've got the rules. Now let's now let's just, you know, go to this. And a lot of students don't even know that they're supposed to be making inferences because they've just been following these procedures. And where I feel I've really been able to reach struggling students is to be explicit with them of, hey, we're actually trying to find all the values here that make something true. What does that mean? Okay, you wanted to add both sides, nine to both sides. Okay, well, how does that relate to the original problem? And this relationship to the original problem, there's all these inferences sort of happening under the surface. And one of the big disconnects I see in sort of math curriculum is, okay, here you have the computational mathematics where maybe you're not explicit about these inferences, even if they're there under the surface. A lot of people aren't aware of them because the curriculum doesn't necessarily demand that they talk about them. And then there's proof-based mathematics where inferences are being made explicit. You have mathematical writing, you have explanation, you have justification. And often people view these things as very distinct. We see this with like algebra and geometry at the high school level. And, you know, then at the college level, you have a situation where, okay, if you want to get to a situation where you're making these explicit inferences, you have to get through all the implicit computational stuff first. And one of the things I thought about a lot is sort of these norms, social norms of communication in math education. And of course, a lot of disabled people might have different social norms in their community. A lot of social norms are perceptual norms and that sort of thing. And one of the things I've thought a lot about was when I was teaching Calc 3. So Calculus 3 is vector calculus. And so what this means is we're doing a lot of computations and visualizations in three dimensions. It will start with, you know, imagine a plane, it intersects another plane, it forms a line, and then you have a third plane, and that's perpendicular. And I panicked when I was assigned to teach this because it's not straightforward for me to visualize these things. And one of the things that happens is a lot of the mathematics is left implicit and based. So it's sort of leaving you to think about, to imagine things. It's based on you imagining visual things. Or even if you're talking about, like, there's something called the right hand rule, and I can't do it. I always get my TA to do it, having to do with the way vectors are oriented. Okay, put your right hand like that. I don't. Yeah. And so all this stuff is sort of, I would sort of describe as sort of sensory almost, and sensory and implicit. And you have all these social norms. So for example, if you give a student a diagram, a contour diagram that shows some information about a graph, and you ask them, okay, is this point like a maximum or a minimum? In order for them to answer the question, they have to be able to make all these implicit assumptions. Like we assume that all the quote important information in the graph, in the function is being shown in the graph. So often I tell students, oh, well, you need to assume that if it switched direction, that would be shown in the graph. Or you have to assume that there's no corners. But all of this is often left unsaid. And students sometimes say to me, well, why didn't they tell me that? And, you know, if you say to your teacher, okay, well, the answer is undetermined because here are all these other, you know, edge cases that I thought of. Sometimes the teacher will think you're being a smartass. Other times, that kind of thinking of edge cases, is rewarded, especially in a proof-based context. And so often you're doing this sort of like rule breaking where you're saying, okay, how well specified with this problem? Can I find counterexamples? Can I find edge cases? When is that rule breaking sort of permitted going past these assumptions, and who's allowed to do that rule breaking?
Sounds like a power struggle, really. Yeah?
And extremely. I mean, one of the things I think about that happened to me as a child, I was constantly getting in trouble as a child for reasons I still don't fully understand. One fun fact about me, by the way, is I did not graduate from high school. So it was K-12, put K-12, and I didn't get along too well. I remember being given a writing assignment in second grade where the teacher said, okay, here are your spelling words. You need to write a few sentences at most, you know, at least one, and try to use as many of them as you can in the fewest number of sentences. And I said, okay, I'm ready for this. the sentence I wrote was, my spelling words this week are, and then quoted them all. And it's a bit of an Amelia Bedelia moment, but the teacher, I think, got mad at me and accused me of being a smartass. And I'm like, I thought that was, you know. So you know, how does this relate to what I'm talking about? We have all these social rules and mathematical rules and way that we communicate implicitly in mathematics. And often that implicit communication happens through our senses. And students have to, this communication is often more successful, this implicit communication with students who are non-disabled, students who are white and things like that. And that sort of rule breaking is often more accepted in some populations than others. Now, I haven't studied that formally, but you know, I'd like to someday.
Yeah, that's seen as a sign of leadership. Well, if for people of color, if they are too aggressive or too creative, then mm-hmm. it's seen as a disrespectful extrapolation of you know, going beyond their role. And that's a very mm-hmm. interesting, again, going back to the idea of a power struggle.
Yeah.
That is differentially structured depending on who's the student doing things and how that works.
And I was a white middle-class kid and had these, you know, and was constantly in detentions with power struggles that I didn't even realize at the time were power struggles. So I'm just imagining somebody more marginalized. You know, I had my parents to advocate for me. I had all these other forms of privilege, and not everybody has that. And that's something I also wanted to point out. Often when we talk about disability, you know, I'm coming from this very privileged standpoint where I've gotten a diagnosis, but one of my illnesses, POTS, the average time to diagnosis is over 5 years. And diagnosis is a privilege. And of course, there's all sorts of issues with our medical system as well, even if you do have the privilege of seeing a doctor, of affording a doctor. And so often, you know, educators will say things like, well, of course, I'll make exceptions for students with disabilities. Well, how do you know who they are? Do they even know who they are?
I'm thinking of this communication that AERA put out, I think it was last week or recently, about
AERA,
special education. Yeah, the Black teachers are less likely to refer students for special education, which is in a way kind of contradicting what you're saying. But I think what you're saying in a way is I mean, the diagnosis for good, I'm going to make the distinction, is a privilege of the privileged, if mm-hmm. I think I hear you correctly. Mm-hmm. The diagnosis for the self-destruction, the push-out diagnosis, the one that's set up to put them in the school-to-prison pipeline, is one in which the purpose of the diagnosis is not to help, but actually to destroy. Mm-hmm. I was hearing an author talk recently in a television program about the book he was writing, and he said was talking about this Black family that they had an IEP meeting, and they thought in order to show support, they invited the pastor and they invited a bunch of people from the community to show how much support mm-hmm. the student had. And the people in the school, this suburb school, got very nervous, and they said all these people couldn't get in, just the parents. Because they saw that as threatening, as a way of overturning their power, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting how diagnosis can work both ways.
Yes, but I mean, K-12, it's Paulo and I have had many discussions about this because I'm admittedly very, I'm not as informed as I would like to be about K-12 special ed. But we've talked about this a few times where, you know, it operates very differently in college. And we've had these discussions where, you know, maybe I'm reading a paper and it will say something like, oh, and, you know, this is, it's tragic because these students of color will be placed in special ed and that's bad. I'm like, wait, what? You know, what's wrong with special ed? And, you know, there's different layers happening here, right? Like with the racism interacting with the ableism. And
yeah, I mean, we will have in our audience some educational psychologists listening, watching us to say this. But I one thing that I noticed as an advocate, disability advocate in IEPs in many contexts, is that the teachers, the special ed folks who are controlling the IEP process, they keep invoking this psychologist who usually never ever goes to the meetings. So mm-hmm. It's almost like God. You're adoring this God of sorts that mm-hmm. made the diagnosis and came up with the assessment and this and that. And you're basically talking about somebody who doesn't teach the student, mm-hmm. who probably has not had any interaction except for the assessment interaction. Mm-hmm. That's not really, I mean, is instructed about these inferences and all these different components, but they don't have the content, mm-hmm. Mathematical content formation that you would have to actually deal with these sort of issues. So it's interesting how diagnosis works mm-hmm. in different contexts. And I think in college, it is to some extent similar in the sense that the disability studies programs, they have these assessments and they are done. And then they tell students, yes, you qualify or you don't qualify mm-hmm. and this and that. So there's kind of an invisibility of power that especially given to the psychologists who are the ones behind, I don't know, in the backstage, really making determinations that are impacting both the life of teachers and the lives of students, right?
I mean, this is one of these things I think about a lot, where I think that there's a major disconnect between, you know, educational psychologists, special education professionals, mathematicians and mathematics education researchers and teachers. And a lot of that disconnect is when we're saying students have a math, when we're diagnosing, I don't diagnose students, but when students are being diagnosed with a math disability, often what's not discussed is, well, what do we mean by math and how does that relate to the way that the student sort of perceives the world? And I think that,
and also ignores the social aspect of that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's only the student who has the disability and not taken into account, well, what is happening? How is the teacher? What are the messages? What are the practices? And so you're blaming the student for the disability and ignoring everybody else. And mm-hmm. so that's, yeah. Also, really quickly, I think, Alexis, you mentioned AERA. And again, just for folks who don't know what AERA is, AERA is the American Educational Research Association. And Alexis, you mentioned that paper came from there, right?
Yeah, it was a communication referring to this particular paper, that the study shows that Black, and this is for the United States, it would be interesting to see if it applies in a comparative cross-national kind of a study. But this particular study seems to be unique to the United States, that Black teachers are less likely to refer Black students to special education, which also shows what you're saying, Paulo, that there are social elements that are triggering the referencing process.
And a political element. Like,
exactly.
Because like in states like Texas, I mean, we know the disability students who receive special education services across the country as aggregate is like 13%. But in Texas, it's like 9%. And why is that? I mean, there's sort of a cap. Like we don't want to diagnose many students of having to then being provided special education services. So, I mean, then like it doesn't matter really if you're the race of your educator. Like if there's a political force there, then hey, the whole state we're gonna have way below, like significant below average of students who receive special education services.
Hi there. While we intend to make our podcast as accessible as possible, we ask those that have the financial means to support us by subscribing as a patron to our podcast for as little as $5 a month. To subscribe, go to our website, disabilityed.podbean.com. By subscribing as a patron, you will help ensure that we can continue to create and share new episodes while supporting other co-conspirators who face financial and health difficulties. For those with financial difficulties, please connect with us about obtaining a free copy of our books and or engaging in additional conversations with us. You can also support this show by hitting the follow button, share this podcast with among your network, and leave us a comment and positive rating. Your support means so much.
Often, in some ways, diagnosis affords opportunities. And I think this is especially true in the college case, where students sort of have the discretion of where they want to disclose and how. But in the K-12 case, often my understanding, the K-12, again, it's not my area of expertise at all, but students often then lose opportunities with math, because then what happens is, okay, they get placed into certain programs where we need to catch students up on, you know, on their math fluency. Okay, so let's take this procedure they're struggling to learn and then just break it down into a more digestible procedure. So it's still fundamentally the same approach. And then they lose the opportunity to engage with mathematics authentically.
And you get a greater gap between the procedures and the inferences, which are really the stuff that you really want to get at. Because the more you break these procedures and you make them quote unquote digestible, the farther you get away from the inferences and the heart of the stuff that you really want to convey through the curriculum.
Yeah, and often when I look at a lot of disabilities are somewhat sensory, and I have yet to see. I mean, maybe it exists, but I have yet to see things saying that, oh, and this disability means you're bad at making inferences, right? Usually it's in a particular context or in a particular way. And I do wonder, like, without this visual bias, how many more people can we empower to make sense of their mathematics? And how many people are just never getting the chance to think about mathematics this way? So one of the people I've talked to a lot about this is my mother. And my mother went to elementary school in Illinois in the 50s. And she thinks she's terrible at math because she cannot memorize things to save her life. In fact, I feel like sometimes she can't move on unless she understands something. But I'll give her problems that I've had plenty of calculus students struggle with. And she'll say, well, you know, that's really obvious. That's just reasoning. I just can't keep track of all these X's and Y's. And, you know, there's been times I've explained math to her and I feel like she understands it right away and she develops really productive understandings. She just doesn't necessarily do well with, okay, now we're going to be completing the square. Now we're going to be doing this procedure and that procedure. And just to clarify, I'm not saying that there should be no procedures. But I am saying that we're missing a lot of opportunities for students to learn about inferences in procedures. And the other thing I think I want to emphasize is I said there is a bit of a disconnect between math education researchers and ed psych and teachers. But one of the, I think, unfortunate things in common is, I think, a bit of a visual tactile bias. At the PMENA working group, we talked about this a little bit in our subgroup, where...
And PMENA,
sorry,
I'm going to call all you all for
Psychology and Mathematics Education North America Conference. We had a fantastic hybrid disability working group. And in one of our subgroups, we talked about disability in math education practice and research. And we feel like a lot of mathematical understanding, when it's assessed, assumes a shared visual and sensory experience. And I think we have to be very careful with this. And one of the areas where I think we really need to be careful with this is what I'm seeing is sort of this paradigm shift towards active learning. And while I think it's great that we're learning about other modalities and learning other ways of learning other than just stereotypical lectures, I feel like disabled people are sometimes left out of the conversation in terms of what does it mean to learn actively? If we're doing embodied cognition, and that's where you're learning in ways where you're moving, what are we assuming about people's sensory experiences when we're having lessons based on these theories?
Yeah, this brings us to a concept you mentioned before we were recording the podcast, this idea of body capital. Could you explain to our audience what you mean by that and perhaps how idea of body capital could be connected to the disconnect between teaching mathematics and disabilities in general, perhaps and VLD in particular?
So I'm still learning more about the construct of body capital. So I don't know if I could speak specifically on that, but I can talk about this notion in the chronic illness community that we talk about as spoons, called spoon theory. And this notion of spoons, it's a bit of a convoluted story for why it's called this, is that nobody has unlimited time and energy, but for disabled people, particularly chronically ill people, and some people with specific illnesses, and in particular long COVID, which is growing, we have a finite amount of sort of like effort and exertion to spend. And we refer to that as spoons. And it's a cost for people to engage in a certain way. And not everybody has that same cost. And I think, you know, in social justice circles, we've done a pretty good job about talking about how not everybody has the same monetary resources, not everybody has the same social resources, but we don't also have the same bodily resources. Not just in terms of being able to do a task or not being able to do a task, but in terms of how long you can engage, in terms of what tasks are draining. And often, I think when we're talking in active learning context, we tend to impose our own biases about how we engage onto others, you know, about making eye contact, about appearing active, rather than, and I think this is disappointing because, so one example of this is Peter Lilliedahl has a book called Building Thinking Classrooms. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not following. Yeah, I'm sure you are.
I am. And it's, I'll just say a lot of people in the math education world love that. So mm-hmm. I'm contextualizing Peter's work.
Warning me. Yeah. I like the book. Alexis, are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not. I'm probably not a good critical reader of that sort of literature, but I'm not familiar with it.
Well, it's written by a mathematics education researcher, and it is based on research, and it has some great ideas. The issue isn't with the book itself, but I would say how people interpret it. So I've just been, you know, informally talking to teachers and people and saying, okay, when you think of building thinking classrooms, what do you think of? What does it mean to implement the practices in this book? And usually the first things people focus on are students standing and sort of in interacting, having these, they call them vertical non-permanent surfaces. So like whiteboards or chalkboards, and standing and interacting and having these spontaneous interactions. And, you know, when you read the book and the work that the book's based on, you kind of learn, well, it's not about standing itself. It's about having a shared workspace for students, or it's about having a non-permanent space. Well, why is a non-permanent space is important? Because it's about making students feel brave enough to share about ideas. And we keep looking into this deeper. We learn, okay, it's not really about body posture. It's just, you know, that's just a way of getting a large population of people to have this shared working space or to
relational creativity. That's basically what you want to foster, right?
Yeah. And so, but what happens though is people see it and they go, oh, okay, people moving around the classroom, you know, that's good. We like to see that. That's active learning. And teachers don't have the time resources to read the studies necessarily. And so they say, okay, we're going to implement building thinking classrooms. One teacher said, oh, is that the guy that took our furniture away? And it's, I mean, I love students collaborating and working on whiteboards together. That's great. But many other disabled people have talked about how this could be problematic for them for a variety of reasons. And one of the big projects I'm working on right now, I'm just starting, and to be honest, I don't feel like I know what I'm doing, is thinking about how to work with teachers about incorporating accessibility into active learning. Because one of the things that we see with disability accommodations, particularly in college, is sometimes instructors will say, well, that accommodation doesn't make sense for the way my class is structured. So the sort of form accommodations often assume a traditional lecture environment. And so, you know, we need to start looking at, and some people have started looking at it. There's one paper by somebody in San Diego, I think. Anyway, talking about accessibility and active learning in STEM. And, you know, it's these surface features that people focus on. I remember once when I was a high school teacher, I knew that I'm an idea person, right? I'm not somebody who focuses a lot on form. Sometimes I think about form, but I tend to focus more on the ideas. And I thought, okay, I need this to look more active. And it was a nice day out in San Francisco. And I'm like, you know what? Let's go take the chalk out and do all the problems in sidewalk chalk. And we were doing just the most mundane textbook problems, but people went around, oh, wow, you know, you're really engaging the students. This is so innovative. You're doing active learning, but they were just normal textbook problems we were doing on chalk outside. We had a good time, but, you know, was that the real goal? And I think a lot of this is marketing. You know, you can't take a picture inside somebody's head. I mean, you can, but you can't show them doing math. And so sometimes when you want to say, hey, look at the cool education stuff we're doing, you can't easily convey, well, look at these, you know, productive, maybe I shouldn't say productive, but useful, good, interesting ideas that students are constructing inside their head. Instead, it's easier to say, okay, well, here's a photo. Look at these students with the manipulatives and moving and doing things. And I think that might also be part of it is communicating about active learning to other people. And just to clarify, I don't mean to insult active learning or Peter Lilliedahl's book. I think it has.
I think what I want like more clarity on is like, where could it go wrong? Like you mentioned, like we don't think about disabled folks when we do like thinking classrooms in math. And so what are some things that happen? Like where teachers might just say, oh, I'm doing thinking classroom. And then what, because you mentioned accessibility, I guess I'm asking you, can you say more about that?
I need to pull up the old PowerPoint I have. I can't find it, but I'm just thinking about, I can tell you from my own personal perspective. So I have POTS and it means I have blood pooling in my legs. And so going up to write on the chalkboard and putting my arms above me, I can technically do it, but it has a cost. I'm going to have to recover later. It means I won't be able to do as many other things in the day. And I've been in situations where I've had instructors angry at me that I'm not just going up and doing problems on the board. And so that's a problem for me or for anybody who can't just easily stand and write on the board and do this.
Yeah, I write Braille, so how could I do that in the board? Or yeah, there's a lot of things that are, you know, I can dictate somebody and somebody else will be doing it for me. Is that accessible enough? Is that violating the rules? Come back to the issue of rules and who gets to be permitted and why. I think that's the most important question. To break the rules, yeah, to break the rules of active learning or the rules of whatever type of, because we kind of worship these procedures or context or pedagogical mythical things that are made up out there. I mean, that seems to be what you have in mind in terms of accessibility, right, Allison?
Yeah, and often people's focus on sort of these external markers of engagement. And we see this, you know, not just in students who are learning, but also, you know, with professionals. One of the things we've talked about, so my axe to one of my axes to grind is about COVID, where, you know, many marginalized people are still highly at risk, and also remote instruction. When COVID started, a lot of people said, and this is a wonderful New York Times article, I think it said, it took a pandemic for me to be able to attend my kids' PTA meeting, because it was a chronically ill woman who just didn't have the spoons to go to these meetings. But when it was on Zoom, she could. And now that people are, you know, pretending that the pandemic is over, or pretending that COVID's no longer a risk, and we see these accessibility measures being taken away. And so not only are people at risk for COVID, sometimes they're losing the way that they engage best. And, you know, we see this a lot. People say, oh, you know, we don't want to have a Zoom option on conference because people just Zoom in and, you know, don't go to other talks. Okay. Well, what about the people who go in person to their hotel rooms and only go to their talks? You know, it's this sort of thing where we have a particular sort of, I want to almost call it like externalized. Alexis, I'm thinking more about what you were talking about earlier, but like this externalized picture of engagement, because how else are we going to perceive it, of engagement, of learning?
And I can think of some people who may have anxiety mm-hmm. in interacting in these contexts. Some mm-hmm. some autistic folks in this spectrum are less likely to feel comfortable when they're touched, and you know, people move around and they probably crisscross in a classroom. I mean, there are some things that are also connected to mental disabilities or some other types of components that are just not taken into account when all these things are set at them.
When we talk about non-permanent surfaces, what about somebody with a short-term memory issue? I had a student recently who had a brain injury, one of my most impressive students, but had some short-term and working memory issues as a result of that brain injury. So if you're talking about this sort of non-permanence, okay, well, I mean, let's take a look at this step further. Why? What's great about non-permanent surfaces? Students are engaging more. Well, maybe it could be interesting to take a look at this. Maybe they're engaging more because they don't feel self-conscious because there's not a record of their mistakes. Okay, well, maybe we can look at ways for students to engage where they don't feel self-conscious about their mistakes. And you know, the truth is, I don't have all the answers. I just think that, you know, we see a lot of great opportunities in active learning. And I think we should dig deeper and say, well, is it really about standing and moving and these things? Or is it about communicating mathematical ideas? Is it about sharing mathematical ideas?
What would you change if you say you had this Aladdin lamp, you would be given the opportunity to ask your wishes to that genie that comes out of the bottle, what would you ask the genie to implement magically? And I mean, 1, 2, 3 things that you think could help tackle some of these disconnects that we have talked about in this podcast.
The first thing, so this is a phrase, I came up with it, but it probably exists out there as well. I don't want to say I Columbus this phrase because I need to look into it more. But intellectual empathy. I talk about empathy a lot. It really guides my thinking. Empathy for students and their perspective, but also intellectual empathy and trying to imagine what it's like to be them and the way that they're thinking. Because when students make mistakes, it's often not just some like, oh, the student's stupid or something like that. Usually there's something interesting and coherent happening in their mind according to their norms that they understand. That's usually really, really quite interesting. The second thing I would say, and this relates to the first thing, is to believe people about their needs, and to give people an opportunity to meet their own needs. So if we're talking about body posture, for example, some students might need to stand, some people might need to sit. It's good to have a variety of furniture. and not just say, okay, here's that one disabled student who needs to sit. So I think believing people about their needs and destigmatizing their needs. And then I think relatedly is interrogating our own presumptions about professionalism and about engagement. Because I think that there's a lot of bias here where if somebody's not engaging in the way that we think that they should be, we're much more critical. So for example, I can imagine like a parent and a child's looking at their phone and misses what the parent says. And the parent says, well, you missed that because you were looking on your phone. Okay, maybe. But what if another incident, the child wasn't looking on their phone and they missed it and they said, I missed what you said. Is the parent going to be as critical that time? So I think we implicitly sort of like impose our expectations about engagement, about professionalism, and what it looks like to engage with ideas and engage with mathematics in particular on other people. And I would really, if I had an Aladdin lamp, I would give people the self-awareness to think about how to start just to be open to those biases. So not even lamp worthy. We can be open to the fact that we have these biases without necessarily knowing these particular biases and really continue to interrogate those things.
I like what you said about interrogating, because it goes along with, I think, a theme that I hear when we talk about, Alexis talks about worshiping, talking about God. I mean, there are these things that happen, and when we go about it unquestioned, or we feel like we have to be complicit, or there's too much risk in doing these. So, I mean, I think what I hear you saying is that as educators, as families, as disabled folks, I mean, these are the things that we could do to kind of push back against sort of these dominant practices that are taken for granted as, yeah, this is good. This is what math knowing and doing is. This is what counts. This is what engagement looks like. And this is how things are. So I really like that. I do want to ask you a question, though, going back to this idea of inferential and versus procedures, because I gather that there are things we could do in, because we have a way, if you will, a channel to reach folks at the K-12 disabled students via the IEP, so the individualized education program. And so, as you know, I mean, a lot of the goals are written based on procedures and procedures only. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like, you know, what do you feel like that is an opportunity to kind of insert, and where can we do that? Like, when should we start thinking about that in a child's journey in their math education, if you will, in K-12?
I think that's a great idea. I think one of the problems that we'll run into is with teachers, because based on what I've seen for studies on teachers, a lot of teachers themselves don't necessarily view math inferentially. My friend and colleague Jody Frost has some interesting work on pre-service teachers not knowing what solve for X means, or at least not having the meaning that was targeted by the curriculum. And so, I mean, this is just such a large systemic issue. I think I think that there's an opportunity to, when we look at students' accommodations, so for example, sometimes a student might have one of their accommodations be a memory aid for procedure. And although it's great for students to get that accommodation, I think when you see that, it's great to say, okay, does this mean everything we're doing is memory-based? Are we is that the goal of instruction? I mean, even if it's one of the goals, is that the only goal? Because one of the things that I found, and I don't want to this is purely anecdotal. This is not my area of expertise, but I had some students when I was teaching high school experiment without using their memory aids. And they did well, but it was in problems that were not memorization based. Right. So if you're looking at somebody's, I mean, maybe there's a larger metaphor here to be made about somebody's disability aid, right? If somebody needs a particular disability aid, yes, they need that aid and that should not be questioned. But the question is, then why is society structured such that they need that aid? Is that something we should also look at, right?
Yeah, and when I kept using the idea of worshiping and God, I was thinking of this idea of idolatry, that I think what happens with a lot of these aids is we create a market. Mm-hmm. And the market fits in itself. You have the industry behind it that also wants to diffuse more of this particular kind of communication aid or memorization aid, and it gets built as part of the pedagogical elements when it's really external and in many ways idolatrous component. Of
a disability dongle. Have you heard that?
No, that's
hashtag
new.
Disability dongle. Yeah.
Dongle. How do you spell dongle?
D-O-N-G-L-E. You'd find it. It's a hashtag. It's basically like when some techie like creates, you know, a wheelchair that climbs stairs when somebody could have put down a ramp, you know, that sort of thing. Not that you shouldn't do that, but why wasn't there a ramp, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, now we're not going to focus on ADA compliance. We just all need to get this mm-hmm. superpower machine that mm-hmm. solves dongle. I don't even, English is not my first language. So the word dongle, I will need to find the proper translation. Yeah, but it's an interesting.
I feel like it's one of those things you, like when I think about dongle, it's one of those things you hook up to your computer so that it can accept other kind of input or output. So your computer doesn't have that. So you need a dongle for it to have this special connection.
Oh, okay. Very interesting.
So I just realized I had one other axe to grind here for educators listening is about interpreting quantitative data, right? So one of the things I've thought about a lot lately is what do we view as evidence for something? And I would say right now, people are largely focused on not everybody, but people tend to really like quantitative information and randomized control trials, RCTs. And I think it's careful. It's important to say, well, you know, what is your research question? And by using this method, what are you answering? And the reason I say this is because even if like, say some intervention is shown to improve something for the majority of people and shown that quantitatively, right, doesn't necessarily mean it should be applied to everyone. And this is where often I see people weaponizing the notion of what I want to call like science with a capital S, where they sort of weaponize this word science and say, well, this study shows that this is actually more effective. Therefore, you don't need this accommodation. And I see this a lot in learning styles discourse. I've seen this a lot in health.
Another god there for you.
Right, yeah. The idolatry of those things, especially randomized trials, the whole experimental worshiping, right?
Yeah, and of course, like those are great methods to use, but you just have to be like, say, what does this tell you? Okay, well, this tells you something about this intervention in this context with a large number of people. I mean, one example of this would be like, okay, if we forced everybody in the country to eat less sodium, overall, probably the health of the country would increase. Because most people probably eat too much sodium for themselves, or most people maybe have too high a blood pressure. I don't know. I'm just making something up here. Hopefully not being ableist while I do it. But okay, even if that's true, there's still going to be people you're hurting that need more sodium. And it's not anti-science for those people to say, actually, I need more sodium. But often they would be treated that way. Maybe not in that context, but often in an educational context where we talk about people's needs. Let's say, well, actually, I need this information given to me verbally, or I need this written down. And somebody says, well, you know, this study shows that, you know, and I think that we can look at studies, but be careful about taking quantitative studies and applying them to individuals. And I think this is where we have to talk a lot about our values, right? Like, as instructors, is our goal to increase the pass rate of students, or is the goal to increase opportunities for students to learn? And are those goals in conflict with each other? And I think it's really important to look at what are our goals as educators, and specifically who are we shoving under the bus?
Yeah, it made me also think about like what you're talking about, the godlike worshiping of measurability, quantitative data only in, like, we're talking about IEP, so individual education programs, interventions, if you will, right? The response to intervention. I mean, those are all like, oh, it has to be measurable. When I talk about, well, what about other ways that we can look at this besides quantitatively?
And they are the ones who measure, and they control how it gets measured. We come back to this issue of social norms, because it's not like measured by an independent actor that's doing some sort of external evaluation of what's going on there. It's typically something that is, quote unquote, measured by the school itself, creating their own mechanisms to quantify and create a fiction of compliance.
We use the proof evidence-based, right?
Well, even Alexis, even if it is like an external person, like, who is this external person? I shared before in the podcast that I've been IEP meetings where they talked about, oh, we're going to get an external person. Isn't that great? And this external person is a applied behavior analysis person.
This happens all the, like, insurance companies. All right, let's go get an external person to evaluate, you know, whether or not your insurance should cover this treatment for your illness that your specialist has ordered, or people getting on disability benefits. Okay, your doctor has said you need them. All these other people have said, okay, no, we need to get this independent person who has, you know, quote, independent person who obviously is going to have their biases as well. And these things sort of, you know, reinforce each other. And I think it's important to remember that science and education are politicized. They're politicized and they relate to, you know, and power influences them. And one of the things I've been so sort of disappointed by is over the past few years in some of my social circles is sort of the science with a couple capital S. Oh, trust science. Okay, yeah, we should like, you know, I'm not just some random expert on some random things, right? Somebody has a PhD on a topic that's definitely not mine. They definitely know more about it than I do. Absolutely. But science is still an institution. Education is still an institution. And they're not free from biases that need to be looked at, especially when we're talking about marginalized populations. So when I see, you know, things being, you know, these evidence-based things that truly are evidence-based for a large population being applied to individuals in ways that are harmful, like that's really concerning. And I think this happens a lot with large universities, with policies where we'll say, okay, well, we find that overall students pass more if we never give any extended deadlines. I mean, I don't know if they found that, but say they did and say it was true. And we found that it motivates the students who are not interested as much. Okay, but at what cost, right? And that's where you get back to your values, right? You have to think about What is your goal of instruction? Is it just to increase the maximum number of people passing, or is it equity-based?
Well, we've really taken a lot of your spoons today. It's definitely being a very fruitful conversation for me. And I was, to begin with, I didn't know anything about NVLD. And I think the contextual conversation around that experience in a firsthand voice with your expertise in mathematics, I think has been really illuminating for me. So thank you for that. And thank you for the opportunity to grow with you in reflecting about it. These various things. I definitely want to say I really got stuck with this idea of the wisdom of mistakes. I think there should be an article written with that title, because I think there is a profound component there, not just in terms of the relational empathy mm-hmm. aspect that you mentioned. I think there is something about even the phenomenology of mistakes and mm-hmm. how they are construed and how much wisdom there may be, perhaps.
I need to write that down. Phenomenal.
Deconstructing them, yeah, that sort of idea. So thank you for that.
Thank you for the great ideas. And for anybody listening, I'd like to say I open collaborations. I especially would love to talk to teachers who are really on the ground more than I am about implementing more accessibility into active learning contexts.
Yeah, and with that, Alex and I will echo Alexis's comment. It's been such an honor to have you. Your stories, insights, and ideas are so powerful. And if folks do want to connect with you and want to collaborate with you, how can they do that?
Well, one of the terrifying things is I seem to be the only Allison Mirren on Earth. So you can find me on Facebook, where I run a support and advocacy group for disability and education. It's called Academic Spoonies. You can also find me on ResearchGate. If you just Google me, you can email me. And I try really hard to give a workshop or two every year at Mathematics Educator Appreciation Day MEAD, which has a virtual option. It's hosted by the University of Arizona. And so that's also a great opportunity. Thank you so much for having me, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for engaging with the DES podcast. We post new episodes every few weeks. The DES podcast is made possible and sustainable in solidarity with you and those who generously volunteer their time to converse with us. We hope you join us on our next episode.